My guest at this time is Ryan Morrow. He's an adjunct professor of Homeland Security and national security analyst at the Clarion Project. He is a highly respected analyst of the terrorist threat we face, and as America marks 14 years since the 9/11 attacks and 3 years since the terrorist attacks in Benghazi, we're asking Mr. Morrow to size up the threat posed by radical Islamists and how the U.S. ought to approach the possible arrival of thousands of Middle Eastern refugees. And Ryan, thanks very much for being with us.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me.
Obviously, a lot is different 14 years since 9/11. As a nation, we're much more vigilant today, and the scope of the threat has changed from these grand-scale attacks like we saw in 9/11 to more targeted acts of terrorism. How well is America being protected from radical Islamists right now?
Well, in terms of radical Islamic terrorism, we're certainly more well prepared just because of all the lessons that are learned since 9/11. So I would say we're safer from a 9/11 style attack that's more sophisticated and therefore easier to intercept. We are less safe, I think, from those more what's sometimes falsely called the lone wolf attacks. And I say falsely because they usually are communicating when working with somebody. But those smaller attacks, the reason that we are less safe is just because of developments overseas, because of the appeal of ISIS, because of the trends that we're seeing overseas and here at the U.S., where there are an increasing number of terrorists and terror plots. So the data speaks for itself. The actual threat of terrorism is increasing, even if the style of terrorism, a 9/11 style, has decreased as a threat.
Talk a little bit more about how we can gauge the extent of the smaller attacks. You mentioned a lot of times these people do communicate, but it's obviously easier to fish that out after the fact, and we know who they were after events like Garland or Chattanooga, Tennessee, and that sort of thing. So what do we know for sure about how common this is around our country, these people planning these smaller attacks?
Well, it's hard to say how common it is because not everyone that is being investigated is going to have that information public knowledge. But if you look at the data, what you see is a multiple times over increase in the number of Salafist terrorists, which is the Al-Qaeda brand around the world, the number of attacks around the world. And here at home, terrorism expert Patrick Poole did a compilation of the different terror-related cases. And what he found was that in the first 6 months of this year, it was double that of the past 2 years combined. So the appeal of ISIS because of their perceived success overseas really caused a spike in radicalization here at home, and that's simply what the numbers tell us.
So what do we do about it?
The biggest thing that we have to do is have an ideological strategy. You need to screen those that are coming into the United States. Not focus solely on the violent act, the violent illegal act, the person about to set off the bomb. What we need to have is an ideological strategy where we embrace those that stand against the Islamist ideology overall. Islamist meaning those Muslims that take their faith and they turn it into a political doctrine, combining mosque and state, calling for the destruction of Israel, and really wage an ideological battle on that basis rather than having a strategy that focuses on one group and then the next group, or just on the bomb going off itself. We need to have an ideological strategy that discredits the premises that create ISIS in the first place.
Well, let's talk about the strategy as it relates to a present-day story, and that, of course, is the flood of either migrants or refugees, depending on who you listen to, into Eastern Europe and also in places like Turkey and Greece and elsewhere from the Middle East, particularly folks displaced, it would appear, by the war in Syria. Different countries around Europe are taking in thousands of these folks. Reports suggest the Obama administration is considering taking in at least 10,000 here. Some folks see this as a major infiltration opportunity for the enemy. Some say there is that threat, but we still have a humanitarian obligation here. And others say it's outright fear-mongering. How do you look at the threat potentially coming from this?
Well, we do know that refugees have come to the United States and become residents or naturalized citizens. There are cases where they become terrorists, they become extremists. And that's because when you look at the process of radicalization, very often those involved in terrorism move from one location to the next, and then they get wrapped up in a new social circle that's very destructive. And so you have to look at it from that perspective, even if the majority of refugees don't want to have anything to do with a group like ISIS or Al-Qaeda. I have a little bit more of a middle approach. There are those that say no Muslim refugees into the U.S. at all. It's not worth it. There are those that say bring in as many as we can. My middle approach basically says this. We need to have a massively well-funded verification process to vet these individuals for on an ideological basis, not ties to a terrorist group, but what they actually believe, and then let in as many of those that pass that test as possible. And now that's going to take a long time. So what do we do about these refugees that are stuck in these different countries? I would support giving them humanitarian aid while they are over there. So it doesn't pose a threat to us, but still out of the goodness of our hearts, I want to help them. And if you're providing them with medical aid, stuff that can't go to the cause of terrorism, then that's something I could support. But before we allow people into this country, there has to be an ideological vetting process.
How does that work? In other words, is it possible to cheat the system? If they know that you're looking for people who could be radically Islamic, they could potentially lie? Or is there a way that it makes it much tougher for them to game the system?
They can lie, but one of the remarkable features, especially of the ISIS brand of terrorists, is how honest they are. You can look at their Facebook and see what they're saying, if they're saying radical things. Look at their Twitter account, and you can tell who is radical and who isn't, even if they aren't declaring support for ISIS, even though in many cases you can. If they are so radical to the point where they decide that they are going to infiltrate the system and lie to get in here, there's probably going to be some information at that point about their ties to that group, if it's advanced to that point. And then on the lower level, then you deal with radicals who haven't chosen a group or actually reached out to a group, and what do you do about them? That's when you look at their social media account, you go through an interviewing process, and you ask them questions about their ideological belief, and you can do that about Muslims and non-Muslims. But I think that there's nothing wrong with, when you're letting someone into this country, asking them what their opinion is of jihad and democracy and different things that can help us understand what it is that they believe and what type of beliefs they'll spread once they're here.
We're talking with Ryan Morrow. He's an adjunct professor of Homeland Security and National Security Analyst at the Clarion Project. And a bigger picture question as we exit here, Ryan. Leading up to the 9/11 anniversary, we heard the news that Ayman al-Zawahiri, the new leader of al-Qaeda, well, new since the death of bin Laden anyway, sent out an audio message essentially declaring war on ISIS, accusing Baghdadi, the ISIS leader, of sedition, and insisting that he was not the leader of all Muslims. That essentially looks a little bit like a caliphate spitting match here, but how should we interpret this?
To some degree, it's desperation. Zawahiri recognizes that ISIS could absorb al-Qaeda and the Taliban, but what's interesting is that in that audio, Zawahiri starts talking about Taliban leader Mullah Omar as if he's alive. We know in recent months it was announced that he's dead. So this audio is from a while ago, and that being in the audio may actually reinforces the ISIS attack on al-Qaeda, saying that they're not relevant with the times, that they're out of the loop. So I think this backfired on al-Qaeda. And the other fact I want to point out there is that there was a poll done in November of 2014 of 900 Syrian refugees in the country surrounding Syria. And this is important so that you understand what we're dealing with. 4% of those Syrian refugees said in those interviews that they had positive feelings towards ISIS. Another 9% said that they are somewhat positive. So according to that poll, you're looking at about 13% at least of Syrian refugees that have sympathies towards ISIS.
Ryan, obviously the work goes on. Thank you very much, sir, for being with us today. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Ryan Morrow is an adjunct professor of Homeland Security and National Security Analyst at the Clarion Project. I'm Greg Corumbus reporting for Radio America.